Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the New Books Network. Today, I'm delighted to have with me Professor Baidik Bhattacharya. Professor Bhattacharya is Associate Professor, Center for the Study of Developing Societies. He has worked on postcolonial literature, the formation of the novel, among many other themes. His first book, Postcolonial Writing in the Era of World Literature, Texts, Territories, Globalizations, interrogated Postcolonial Literature and World Literatures, and his latest book, which just came out last month, or the month before that, I think, Colonialism, World Literature, and the Making of the Modern Culture of Letters, takes this argument further by talking about a crucial period in the formation of these fields. And I'm very excited to talk to Baidik about this. So first of all, Baidik, welcome to this podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Baidik, why don't we start with you telling us a bit about yourself and how you came to write this book?
Sure. I trained in English literature. You know, all my degrees are in English literature. I studied here in Delhi at Jawaharlal Nehru University for my MA and MPhil. Then I went to Oxford at Ulsan College to do my DPhil in English. Then I taught for a brief while for about 4 years in England. Then I came back, I taught here at Delhi University for about 8 years. And now I'm at a research institute called the Center for the Study of Developing Societies, or CSDS. Now, this book is partly inspired by my journey as a student of English literature, but also partly inspired by my earlier book that I published in 2018. What happened in that book, I was working at the cusp of, you know, postcolonial studies on the one hand and world literature studies on the other. And I wrote mostly about contemporary novelists like J.M. Kutzia, Salman Rushdie, V.S. Naipaul, and so on. But while I was interrogating the idea of world literature, and particularly when I was looking at some of the colonial documents, colonial era documents, documents from colonial archive, I was struck by the fact that many of the things I learned as a student of English literature, as a student of literary studies, through my training in literary studies, I could virtually see some of those ideas, or at least their traces, their genealogies, strewn across the colonial archive. Many of the ideas with which we work now as students of literature, many of those ideas I could see actually came out of colonial era engagement, colonial governance, colonial documents, and things like that. So that really caught my attention. And I thought there was a different book lying there where I can look at some of the foundational ideas of literary studies and colonial archives together, and I can trace them across one another. You know, that was the idea that inspired this book. So when I wrote this second book, I was partly thinking of my training as a student of English literature, my BA, MA, MPhil, DPhil, etc., what I have been taught, how I have been taught, and how many of these ideas actually have their roots in colonial governance, in colonial archives. So that is how this book was born, in a way.
I'm glad you brought that up, Vaidik, because your book seems to be intervening in a large body of scholarly literature on colonial knowledge production. Historians like Nicholas Dirks, Bernard Cohen have worked extensively on this. So can you give us maybe a sense of this literature that exists on this on these colonial archives that you have worked on? And how is your scholarship intervening in these existing debates?
See, colonialism has been studied for a while. It's not a new field. I'm not exploring a virgin field in that way. Colonialism, modes of colonial knowledge production, colonial governance, various aspects of colonial governance, these things have been studied for a while. And you mentioned two of the very, very important scholars, both Barnett Cohn and Nick Dirks. They have expanded our knowledge, they have expanded our understanding of how the colonial state functions. Now, for instance, if I take just one example, Barnett Cohn or Nicholas Dirks, you know, Nicholas Dirks has this very interesting idea of an ethnographic state, that by the end of the 19th century, the British state in India, the colonial state, became an ethnographic state. So this idea of, you know, ethnographic state was very appealing to me. While I was working, however, I could see a prior stage to this, which is what I, in my book, I call a rule of philology. That before ethnography became so central to colonial governance and colonial mode of knowledge production, philology played a far significant role in the colonial governance itself. In the early stages, late 18th century onwards, philology was one of the central disciplines that was invented partially through colonial governance, particularly the form of comparative philology that we see now. And it was also deployed as part of colonial governance. Across the border, philology was one of the central disciplinary formations through which the colonial state wanted to understand and engage with Indian society. So this is a kind of, in my book, you can say that I'm in dialogue with this existing scholarship, that this scholarship is very central to my thinking. At the same time, I'm also going beyond this existing scholarship. I'm trying to find, particularly through the archival material, different aspects or different areas which have not been commented upon or which have not been looked at so far. So, for instance, this emphasis on philology is one area which I think would be quite new in my argument, because philology or its centrality in colonial governance has not been studied in very detail. In Barnard Cohn's work, you actually have some references to this you know, emphasis on language, emphasis on literary texts, and this gradual mastering of Indian languages, you know, language of power and power of language, that very well-known essay. That gives you some initial inroads into the early colonial system or early colonial formation, state formation. But philology, how it plays a central role, how it plays a fundamental role, is something I think that can be probed even further beyond Cohn and others. So in a way, it's a dialogue between existing scholarship like Barnard Cohn, like Nicholas Dirks, and many others. I mean, there is a very vast body of historical scholarship on Indian colonialism or colonialism in India. And I'm in continuous dialogue with that kind of scholarship, whether it's Ranajit Guha, whether it's Partha Chatterjee, whether it's Nicholas Dirks or Barnard Cohn or others, you know, the Subaltern School and others. I'm in continuous dialogue with them.
And I think, as you point out in the book, one thing that this intense sort of colonial focus on philology did was that it contributed to our changed understanding of literature in a way. And you point out that colonial sovereignty was co-produced with what you term as literary sovereignty in the 18th century, which completely changed how we both practice literature and we theorize on literature. So could you tell us a bit about what do you mean by a concept of literary sovereignty, and why is it so important to our understanding of how world literature has developed now?
Yes, there are two things we need to keep in mind. You know, one is that what was happening in late 18th century India was quite unprecedented in colonial history. The British had colonies prior to India. They had colonies in Northern America, in the Caribbean, and also in Ireland. But in all cases, they exported their legal system. So it was British law which was implemented in these colonies. In India, what they did was something completely unprecedented. They actually tried to build a legal system from existing indigenous native legal texts. They identified two bodies of text. The first one is Sharia for Islamic law, and second one is Dharma Shastra for Hindu laws. And they translated these texts from different languages, from Arabic, from Persian, from Sanskrit. They translated these texts and tried to build a sovereignty out of texts itself. This is something very unprecedented in even world history. Just imagine, there is no monarch, there is no parliament, there is no supreme leader as such. There is only a body of texts. So in the classical argument, you know, in Foucault or in Agamben, we have read this body of the despot or body of the sovereign, right? Here, the source of power is not the body of the sovereign, but a set of texts, a bunch of texts, translated into English mostly, and then in other European languages, but translations from various Asian languages like Arabic, like Persian, like Sanskrit, etc. This is the first part that we need to understand. The second part is also, you'll realize, if you train in any literature departments, like I did, for instance, you'll be told that the modern idea of literature as a sovereign order of textuality, which is at the same time autonomous, autotelic, and singular, this idea, this modern idea of literature, is not very old. It emerged during the late 18th century, around the same time when this was happening in colonial India. And you'll be told that this idea of literature emerged with the German Romantics, particularly the Jena Romantics, the two Schlegel brothers and their entourage. Now, what I was trying to do, I was trying to look at this question of sovereignty prior to Romanticism and beyond Europe. And I could see that what they were doing at the same time, they were primarily translating legal texts because they wanted to build a sovereign system out of a bunch of texts, right? But at the same time, they were also translating other texts as well. For instance, somebody like Charles Wilkins was translating Bhagavad Gita. Then he translated Hitopadesha. Jones translated Shakuntala, the most famous translation of that era, for instance, and so on. A whole range of texts they were translating. And this is the time, for the first time, they were arguing that they could identify a form of writing in the Orient or in the East, as they said, which was distinctly different from any European ideal or any European example. Because this writing, this form of writing, was autonomous, autotelic, and singular. Now, what is interesting for me is the overlap between the political project of sovereignty, which is textual, which is also trying to build its or fashion its own being from a very similar form of textuality, an autonomous form of textuality, right? A form of textuality which will be complete in itself, which will not have any extra textual reference. Every point of law will be determined through references to other texts, right? That was the idea of political sovereignty. And the literary sovereignty, the idea of a textual world which is embedded within the text, which is free of any references to extratextual world, which is autonomous, autotelic, and singular in its experience, they actually imitated each other almost. They were definitely co-produced. They were something, they came out of the same history, and they were co-produced as far as I could see. So that's why I thought it's a kind of form of literary sovereignty that I was looking at. Sovereignty is a very, in my opinion at least, sovereignty is a very central idea through which we understand the modern concept of the literary. The literary has its own sovereign being. That sovereignty I'm suggesting in the book is partly derived from a political project, the political project of colonialism in 18th century India.
And so even before the 18th century or late 18th century, texts from India, present-day India, had been circulating in Europe and had been translated by Thomas North and many others. But what marked this new phase of translations off was what you called the colonial untranslatable, which was a kind of a way for these colonial officers and philologists like William Jones to preserve in a way the essence of these texts and claim and make a claim to authenticity, as it were. So can you tell us a bit about these massive translation projects that these colonial officials undertook, and why were they so insistent on what you call maintaining the colonial untranslatable of these texts, and what did that do for their idea of sovereignty?
See, translation was very central to colonialism in India. From the beginning, from 18th century onwards, they invested enormously in translation, particularly translation of legal texts from Arabic, Persian, and Sanskrit initially. And they produced a huge number of translations over the years. By 19th century, there were hundreds and thousands of translations produced by colonial officials of different kinds. But there was a distinct change in the translation policy, in the way they approached the question of translation and the question of autonomy of texts which were being translated. This is something you don't find in pre-colonial texts. For instance, the case I discuss in my book, which is the translation of Panchatantra in different languages. Panchatantra was so popular that by 19th century, by the turn of the century, it was translated into every major language in Asia, Europe, and North Africa. And there were very little anxiety about retranslation. For instance, the one you briefly mentioned, Thomas North's translation, that was the first English translation of Panchatantra stories. Now, North very clearly mentions his source, which is an Italian version, and then also lists other languages in which the corpus existed prior to Italian and from which the Italian version was made. And then he says that I have translated from Italian into English. There is very little anxiety about this retranslation, that it is being translated into different languages and retranslated from those languages, and it was not being translated from the original Sanskrit. There is very little anxiety about it. Now, the colonial officials first made a huge point about translating from the original, that we are accessing the original text. So, for instance, when we have the first colonial era translation of Panchatantra stories, this was Charles Wilkins's translation with the name Hitopadesha. Now, his first point is that I'm translating from the original Sanskrit. I'm not translating from another translation. So, mine is more authentic. That is a claim which is made almost everywhere in colonial translations from 18th century onwards, that we have access to an uncorrupt original version of the text, and as a result of which, our translations are more authentic. That is something they repeatedly say, number one. Number two, once this point about originality is made, there is subsequent investment in the idea of the autonomy of the original. Right, the original is such that it is autonomous, autotelic, and singular. And that sense cannot be fully translated. This is something they are insisting. As a result of which, they develop a whole range of strategies. For instance, they are translating into English. Translations are there, but they are adding notes, they are adding paratextual material, they are adding long commentaries, long introductions, prefaces, etc., etc., with the idea that the full import of the original cannot be conveyed in translation. Translation is necessary, but at the same time necessarily limited, as a result of which the autonomy of the original is something which cannot be rendered fully transparent in translation. This is something they are saying again and again. And this is something I thought is something very interesting and something that has not been explored as much as it should have been. So while I was using some of the existing work on colonialism and translation, this is something which has been studied by many people like Tejaswini Niranjana. She has an interesting book on translation and colonialism by Bernard Cohn, by very recent authors like Siraj Ahmed or Amin Mufti, for instance. They have explored this connection between colonialism and translation, but I was more interested in their insistence on untranslatability. That's why I argue that it is through the untranslatability that they are trying to convey a sense of the autonomy of the original. The autonomy question is very important here, because this is the sense of autonomy which will again define the new idea of literature as well. That literature is an autonomous organization of a text, right? And this autonomy is a singular one. It cannot be represented in any other form. So the untranslatable argument is very closely tied first to the question of autonomy and then to the new idea of the literary itself. That's why I particularly concentrate on colonial untranslatables.
And do you think that this large project of translation also in a way kind of fixed the identity of these texts? Because as I understand it, there were many versions, recensions of these texts that circulated in present-day India back then, during when this project was happening. So in what ways did this translation project shape our understanding of what these texts have come to mean today? And how did that fix their identity as a singular sort of text with fixed meaning and carrying an essence of India even from the pre-colonial past?
Absolutely. See, what they encountered is something which was beyond their experience, which is a pre-print scribal culture. Right? Print was introduced by these colonial officials in many ways. So pre-print scribal culture, where a text existed in different manuscripts, in different recensions, and it was virtually impossible to fix a final reading of a text. So what they did, this is why I say that philology became very important in early colonial rule. They employed a whole range of philological techniques to ascertain a certain reading of a text. Right? So the text, or if we can say something like a being of the text, was fixed through translation. Translation was one of the ways through which they fixed the being of translation. For instance, there is one very important body of texts, Dharma Shastra texts, which they thought were central to Hindu personal law. Now, this is something later Indologists have argued that this was not the case. This is partly because they came through Bengal, and Bengal had this overpowering presence of the Dharmashastric texts. So they thought this was true for the whole of India. So they translated these texts. And the current Hindu civil law, for instance, or Hindu personal law in India, is partly based on these translations. Even today, what Hindu personal law means, or Hindu civil law means, a large part of it is actually derived from these translations. So for instance, William Jones translated Manav Dharma Shastra, which is popularly known as Manusmriti. Now this translation, he argued, is the basis, or should be the basis, of Hindu personal law all over India. By translating, he prioritized one version of it, he fixed it, and he made it popular through colonial governance. Later laws, which were promulgated during the colonial era, they were the personal laws particularly, were based on this translation. So translation, you are absolutely right. Translation was one way of fixing the meaning of a text or the being of a text and to make it available for consumption and circulation.
And so once translations kind of fixed the meaning and being of these texts, as you say, was the next step in this process to initiate comparison and see that as an important framework of understanding India through the analysis of these languages and literatures, comparison not only with, let's say, the European context and even the Persian or other context, but also within India. Can we say that?
Yeah. Comparison became a very central framework from the beginning. You know, comparison is something through which they wanted to understand India. There are two different forces at act here. You need to understand these two different forces separately. One is the Orientalist will to know India, and the other is the colonial mission to produce India as a governable space. These two ideas required comparison, or comparativism, as I call it in the book, comparison as a kind of framework. First, they wanted to understand Indian culture through its comparison with European culture. So, for instance, you'll see in William Jones's writing, he's continuously comparing Sanskrit texts with classical Greek and Latin texts. He's translating Shakuntala, for instance, and comparing Kalidasa as with Shakespeare, and suggesting that Kalidasa is the Shakespeare of India. So on and so forth. So comparison was one way of understanding India through a comparative lens. This idea will find its final climactic expression in the invention of the Indo-European hypothesis. Right? This is something which happened in 1786 during a lecture by William Jones at the Asiatic Society of Bengal. This is known as the third anniversary lecture, or third anniversary discourse rather. And there, he, for the first time, proposed a familial connection between different languages like Sanskrit, Latin, and Greek. He suggested that these languages are from the same family and they're probably derived from a language which is now lost. Now, this similarity is not new. Earlier authors, I cite some of them in my book, they also noted this similarity between Sanskrit on the one hand and Greek and Latin on the other. But Jones was the first one to suggest a familial connection between them. Now, this is something which will be developed later by authors like, you know, Friedrich Schlegel or Franz Bopp, Rasmus Rask and others. They will develop it into what is now known as the Indo-European hypothesis. That this is an Indo-European family of languages which are derived from a Proto-Indo-European language, which is lost, which is irrevocably lost, which cannot be reconstructed. But these are sister languages, let's say. Now, this is a comparative framework, right? This is something which is entirely based on comparison. And this is the starting point for modern or comparative philology as well. So this is one frame of comparison. The second frame of comparison, which is more closely tied to the colonialism part, not the Orientalism part, which is the deployment of comparison as part of various colonial projects. In my third chapter, for instance, I discuss a particular project, late 19th century project called the Linguistic Survey of India, which was done under the stewardship of somebody called George Abraham Grierson. Now, Grierson deployed comparison as a way of understanding India's languages and dialects. Now, there are literally hundreds of languages and dialects he surveyed, and then he recorded them on comparative tables. So if you look at the actual volumes of this survey, they are documents of comparison. They are comparing different languages, different families of languages, different groups of languages. India is the home of various families of languages, right? There is this major Indo-European language in the northern India and partly eastern India. There is this Dravidian family of languages in southern India. There is this Munda and other Austroasiatic family of languages and so on. So what he is doing, if you look at the actual volumes of the survey, it is actually a document of comparison, that it is a comparative method through which he is trying to understand India. This is the ethnographic moment of the colonial state that Nicholas Duff mentions, you know, this idea of the ethnographic state. This is the ethnographic moment. But ethnography is based on comparison. Comparative table becomes the way to understand India. So that is why I think comparison is one major way through which colonialism consolidated itself and through which they made an enormous investment in understanding Indian culture. Culture as a whole is not graspable. Culture can only be grasped through comparison or through comparative tables.
That's very interesting. And the way that comparison emerges as a framework for literature at this moment, in this colonial moment, you also point out how this colonial experience also enabled the earliest formulation of world literature as another sort of way of looking at literary texts and literary cultures. And Goethe, who is acknowledged as the first person to articulate this new category, his articulation comes in the background of what you call as an impure Kantian aesthetics that saw anthropology as an answer to the incommensurability of universal aesthetic criteria on the one hand, and with the actual reality that these colonial officials were struggling to understand, and hence these massive projects to kind of deal with that complexity. So can you tell us a bit about what you mean by an anthropology inflected idea of world literature, and how does the tying of these literatures with the form of the nation undergird our understanding of world literature, its emergence in this moment through Goethe and in the background of Kantian aesthetics and so on?
Sure. See, my argument in the book is that this colonial history, the first part of the book, I track this colonial history of what I call the literary sovereign, that how it emerged, how it embraced different frameworks, how it was deployed in actual colonial governance and so on. In the second part of the book, I argue that Europe made sense of this colonial history through different strategies. And one of the most effective strategy was this idea of world literature. That through world literature, they were trying to accommodate this colonial history, which is coming from British India. Now, if you look at, for instance, Goethe's argument about world literature. Now, Goethe's argument, the first recorded mention of world literature is in 1827 during a conversation with his disciple, Peter Eckermann. Now, what is interesting, Bala Venkat Mani has written an excellent book on world literature where he traces Goethe's reading habits. What he actually read, his personal library, his borrowings from public libraries, and so on and so forth. What Venkat shows is an interesting thing, that Goethe was actually reading an enormous amount of literature in translation, which were coming from the colonial world. Goethe knew Jones's translations, for instance. Goethe knew several other translations. He read, he commented on them. Goethe also knew the enormous research that colonial officials were doing and publishing in the journal called Asiatic Researches. So Goethe was familiar with this colonial project. Goethe knew this colonial project very well. This is something we get from Venkat's book and from Goethe's own reading habits. Now, when he says world literature, it is a way of accommodating that comparative frame that we just mentioned within Europe. That world is something through which you understand the different parts. One part, we have to understand that the world literature is split into two parts. One is world. Mm. How do you define the world? What do you mean by world when you say world literature? And the second part is the literature part itself. Mm. Now, the literature part, I'm arguing that came from the colonial moment, mm. colonial history, and this literary sovereign kind of idea, that mm. this modern notion of literature that came out of this colonial route.
Mm.
The interesting part is world. How do you define the world of world literature? What is the world of world literature that Goethe refers to? Here, my suggestion is that we need to think of a particular strand in German philosophy of mm. that time, particularly somebody whose work Goethe again knew very well. I show in my work that he was a great admirer of Immanuel Kant's work, particularly Kant's third critic, a critic of the power of judgment. Now, if you look at the power of judgment argument, mm. what is interesting in Kant's third critic, unlike the first two, Kant is unable to find a priori principle for the moment of judgment.
Hmm. Hmm?
Taste or judgment is something, he argues again and again, which is local, which is provisional, hmm. which is conditional, but at the same time, with a universal pretension.
Hmm.
This is not a priori, there are no a priori rules that determine the contours of the moment of judgment.
Hmm.
So what do? In the absence of an a priori or universal rules of judgment, what you do, you basically depend on communal consensus. Both beautiful and sublime, mm. these two nodal points of aesthetic judgment for Kant, mm. for both of them, the judgment of beautiful or the judgment of sublime, mm. they eventually depend on a communal consensus, a mm. community which is anthropologically defined. Mm. Community, the idea of community in Kant is an anthropological idea. Mm. It's not an aesthetic category.
Mm. Mm.
That is why I say it is an impure aesthetic, because eventually the idea of aesthetic judgment is dependent on something which is drawn from outside the realm of the aesthetic, which mm. is from anthropology. So that's why I say that in my book, that in order to understand this Kantian moment, mm. you have to include not only the third critic, Critic of the Power of Judgment, but also his book on anthropology, mm. which he wrote towards the end of his life, mm. though he lectured on anthropology throughout his life.
Mm.
Mm. The book, which in English translation is called Anthropology from the Pragmatic Point of View, mm. you have to read this and the third critic together. Mm. That is my argument. Now, what Goethe does is interesting. Mm. This anthropological moment, this communal moment, that finally aesthetic judgment is dependent on a communal consensus, mm. this community, anthropologically inflected idea of community in Goethe's argument immediately becomes the nation.
Mm.
So the world of world literature is a world made of different nations. Mm. It is like a common market where different nations are selling their own goods, and just it happens in a marketplace.
Mm. Mm.
So that is why I'm suggesting this anthropological notion is very important. The second route that I'm proposing is the close connection between the literary and the anthropological from the colonial moment itself.
Mm.
The colonial moment was deeply invested in these two modes of knowing India.
Mm.
This is something Goethe knew very well. As I said, mm. he knew the colonial project very well. He read different translations, he read different publications which mm. were coming out of colonial India at that point. So he knew that other route as well.
Mm.
So for him, there were two resources to fashion this idea of world literature with this notion of anthropology. One was Kantian aesthetics, mm. which was very popular at that point and of which he was a great admirer. During one of his conversations with Eckermann, for instance, he says that this is the most important discovery of our time as far as aesthetics is concerned. Kant's work is very important, very central to my understanding. He says so much. And the second source for Goethe's argument was the colonial archive, which he knew quite well, as we know from Venkat's book, for instance. Hmm. So these two came together to produce the world of world literature, the anthropological notion of world,
mm.
right? So that is why I argue that world literature is a deeply anthropologically inflected category.
Mm. Mm. Moving on from that idea, in chapter 5, you critique Rancière's ideas about democratic petrification that seeks to understand how literature came to literature became literature as we understand it today. And you point out the role that race played in this thinking, racial categories, in how literature was thought and formulated and reformulated in this period, and how race as or these colonies as Europe's colonial other tells us many things about the acts of reading in this period of European readers and writers. So can you walk us through that idea that you're developing in this chapter?
Yes, of course. See, Rancière has been one of the most significant philosophers of our time in order to define what he calls the modern aesthetic regime and the role of literature within this modern aesthetic regime. So, first of all, let me clarify at the beginning, I am a major admirer of Rancière's work. What I think he misses is the contemporary configuration of different knowledge paradigms. For him, the idea of literature, the way we understand it now, or as he calls literature as literature, this becomes possible in the 19th century, early 19th century, when literature embraces the paradigm of everything speaks. He cites something like George Cuvier, for instance, and his works in geology and paleontology, where minute objects can actually tell a story. Right. This is something Rancière calls mute speech, that every object has a mute speech engraved on it. Literature's job is to unearth that speech, is to tell the story of that object. Now, this is something he argues is a story internal to Europe, and it happens in 19th century. He cites Cuvier, for instance, he cites several other instances where he says that this paradigm of everything speaks, of mute letter, of mute speech, etc., this becomes a viable paradigm of thinking, of thought in early 19th century. Now, my argument is that this is not a European story. This idea of the readability of everyday life, right? That everyday life can be read, which is seen as the marker of realism in literature, and particularly French realism, is something which comes from a colonial root. What is important to understand from 18th century onwards, and this is not only about Britain, but also about France, which is primarily the case study for Rancière. Even in France, for instance, you have this Napoleonic invasion of Egypt from 1798 onwards. One of the major outcomes of these invasions was to literally textualize Egypt. Egypt, to understand, to know, this is a point that Edward Said makes in Orientalism as early as it said 1978, that Napoleon actually saw Egypt as an Orientalist. And he deployed an army of hundreds of Orientalists to turn the everyday reality of Egypt into a text. It is a textualization of Egypt and Egyptian life. This is precisely the moment I am arguing here, that is the prehistory or precondition of everyday life, or this mute speech kind of argument. Rancière doesn't understand or doesn't get into this colonial history at all. This is partly a problem, I think, not only of Rancière, but French intellectual scene more broadly. There is a very surprising ignorance of colonialism. Even though France had one of the largest empires in 18th and 19th centuries, there is hardly any reference to imperialism in French critical thought. Rancière is no exception. Rancière, historically, when he looks at it, he only sees French material. As a result of which, Rancière uses a particular novel to argue his case and to flesh out his argument, which is Balzac's novel, La Peau de Chagrin, which is translated into English as The Wild Ass's King. I also use the same novel and the same sequence, the opening sequence of the novel, where the protagonist of the novel, or somebody called Raphael, enters a curiosity shop and encounters pavilions of objects all strewn together. And he reads those pavilions. This is the sequence. Now, this sequence, if you read it closely, this sequence is not possible without the colonial world of the contemporary time. Right. The novel, I think, was published in early 1830s, 31 or 32. I'm forgetting the exact year. This is the contemporary colonial world. Without this contemporary colonial world, you cannot have a scene like this. What he is reading, what these objects and artifacts mean, what he's reading, what he's looking at, is basically a miniature replica of contemporary colonial world. This is a point which is completely missing in Rossier's writing. Rossier doesn't see the colonial trace at all, which is very surprising, given that France had a major colony in the 19th century. I mean, major colonial world, major empire in the 19th century. But Rossier, for some reason, doesn't acknowledge the presence of the colonial world at all. This is something I want to how do I put it? I mean, bring back.
So, on that note, I know your book also talks about decolonizing literary studies, as it were, and literary scholarship, and the way we have come to understand literature now. So, what path do you see forward for world literature as a discipline, and how would you like that path to shape itself through the lens of decoloniality and other things? So if you could talk a bit about that in brief, that would be great. Yeah.
Sure. See, that is my final argument, that this book is actually a practice in decolonization. If I have a working method, by working on this book, that method would be decolonization. Decolonization is something through which I'm walking, with which I'm walking, through which I'm thinking, and this is my overall theoretical framework. Now, what do I mean by this? One interesting part, for instance, literary studies is something which needs to be decolonized. This is something we all say and hear, so on and so forth. Some interesting work has been done in this direction. For instance, I mentioned one particular work, Gauri Vishwanathan's book, Mask of Conquest, which decolonized the idea of English literature. That English literature as a body of text, as a canon, was actually invented in the colony, not in England. But what I'm trying to do here is something very different. The ideas with which we work, not English literature as a canon, but literature as an idea. Right? Literature as a concept, and see it through decolonization and through a method that we often call connected history. That is not, literature is not the descendant of any one intellectual tradition. It's rather a descendant, it is derived rather from a cross current of different cultures, which happened in 18th century India, through colonialism, that different cultures, different cultural worlds came together, they clashed with each other, they negotiated various things, and various new ideas came out of that clash. Literature is one of them. Once we understand this colonial history of some of the central tenets with which we walk, for instance, comparatism, comparatism as a framework, comparative literature, or number of comparative disciplines are very much part of our everyday university lives, right? Now, where does this comparative model come from? This is something I also explore in this book, and I argue that various colonial projects shaped various notions of comparison across time from 18th and 19th centuries. And by the early 20th century, you have something like comparative literature possible. So this is what I mean by decolonization, that to go into the fundamental concepts with which we walk, like literature, like comparison, like many others in the book, for instance, like literary history, for instance, that these are many ideas with which we walk, which are fundamental to our discipline. But at the same time, we need to interrogate their histories. We need to interrogate their enmeshed nature in colonial histories and how this can lead to new ideas and new ways of thinking about our discipline. This is something which I think this entire world literature debate has made possible. It has done something which was seemingly impossible to do, which is to go back in history and to think through some of the fundamental categories and ideas with which we work. For instance, this very notion of the historicity of literature, right? This is something I could do only because of the recent debates in world literature and their interaction with other disciplines like my own specialization, postcolonial studies. So I could actually pitch these two together, postcolonial studies, my interest in colonial archives, my readings of colonial archives on the one hand, and world literature studies debates on the other hand. And I could bring them together in order to explore some of the settled ideas, some of the settled notions of literary studies itself. This is something I think would be the future course of research.
Well, Vedic, it has been lovely talking to you. And well, very quickly, if you could tell us if there are any projects that you're currently working on, or if there's any book or film that you would like to recommend to our listeners, that would be great.
Yes, I'm working on, this is something my supervisor used to say, that we are always working on our next book.
Yeah.
So I'm working on my next book. It will be probably a bunch of essays together, which will interrogate one of the ideas I deploy in this book, but I do not interrogate, which is the modernity of literature. I often say that literature in the modern sense, but I do not specify what is it that constitutes this modernity of literature. So my next book would probably be something like modernity of literature and an interrogation of what and how exactly we understand the modernity of literature itself.
Well, Vedic, it was lovely talking to you, and thank you so much for giving us your time, and hope to talk to you soon again.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. It was really a nice experience.